La Trobe University presents Australia Decides 2013, a podcast hosted by Matt Smith.
Hello and welcome to Australia Decides 2013, a podcast recorded in front of a live audience. Round of applause, live audience. Therefore proving you exist in the lead up to the Australian federal election. It is August the 8th. The election has been announced for September 7th. The morning after Prime Minister Kevin Rudd made the announcement, the Sydney Morning Herald said this.
It's on.
The Daily Telegraph said this.
Finally, you now have the chance to kick this mob out.
And the Northern Territory News said this.
We're off to the races.
In reference to the Northern Territory Cup. Much smaller on the front page.
We're off to the polls.
And finally, ending with a footnote.
It's a sure bet which day will be more fun.
So at least they've got their priorities right. Candidates were quick to trot out their election slogans. Kevin Rudd said this.
Who do you trust?
Tony Abbott said this.
Who is more fair dinkum?
While Liberal candidate for Greenway, James Diaz, said this. I have two guests joining me today. I will ask them to introduce themselves so that you can know their voice. On my left.
Hi, I'm Nick Bisley, the head of politics at La Trobe University.
And on my right.
I'm Nick Barry. I'm a lecturer in politics at La Trobe University.
My first question for today to you both is, what is your thinking on calling an election for September 7th with so little notice? We'll start with Nick.
We haven't had so little notice. This has been on the cards since at least January. It's been in Kevin Rudd's mind since the 23rd of June 2010. So I reckon this is the election with the largest notice just about in Australian history. But when Rudd reclaimed his prize, part of the sort of interest of it was, what's he going to do? When's he going to call it? He was absolutely not going to call it for September 14, least of which was Julia Gillard's favourite date. So that wasn't going to happen. And there was a great deal of delight, I think, they took in seeing Tony Abbott and the coalition more generally not quite know what to do and trying to second guess, third guess, quite what the timing was going to be. Of course, calling the election is the Prime Minister's one great prerogative, and many were quite sceptical of Gillard's handing over that prerogative at the start of the year. And so I think Rudd was exercising that and enjoying it to some degree, and also trying to get some feedback as to just when was going to be the right time. And there was a lot of speculation it was going to be 31st of August. They then get pushed back. I think they were getting some internal polling. I think they got some polling that began to show that things were turning their way. And I think that was one reason why they went a little earlier than many had been anticipating. And I think the bad news on the economy meant as soon as they got that economic statement out, they were going to call the election, because it was clear that if they didn't, the longer you run on, the more and more bad news comes out, then I think you lose whatever advantage you get by staying late. So I thought Rudd was going to be ruled by vanity and not give up the opportunity to grandstand in the foreign policy fantasy land that is the next sort of 4 weeks or so in the global summits. But he didn't. We've got the election on the 7th, and we'll see how it plays out. But I don't think in any way this is unanticipated.
Yeah, and one of the difficulties Rudd had in getting the timing right was he needed to re-establish himself as Prime Minister. But by the same token, you don't want to let the whole thing drag on for too long, particularly once they got a bounce in the polls. Whether it's a sort of mini honeymoon period, you don't know how long that's exactly going to last. So
you don't want the electorate to remember what Rudd the Prime Minister is actually like.
But when they scheduled the election, it's International Vulture Awareness Day. Do you think they took that into account at all?
I think Rudd would have put that through the numbers machine and considered that on balance, the preferences probably weren't going to be too badly shifted by concern about vultures or other avian critters.
The 21st of September, I think they should have gone for that. That's International Earth, Wind and Fire Day. The campaign writes itself. Everybody remembers the 21st of September. That'd be great. That'd be great for television.
Yes, Matt. Yes.
Yep.
This is why you're hosting the podcast and not advising Kevin Rudd.
Okay. Tony Abbott said that he won't lead a minority government. Is that a risky promise to make? And why does he make a promise like that in the first place? We'll start with Nick.
But I think the reason he made that promise is because it links into the strategy they're trying to use against the government, which is to link it to instability, period of turmoil, and also backroom deals as well. This notion of doing a deal with the Greens and Independents in order to secure minority government. Abbott's trying to, I guess, draw a contrast between himself and the government on that one. To be honest, I don't think it's a particularly wise decision. I think the electoral benefit they'll get from it is pretty minimal. And it's hard to believe that if we ended up with a hung parliament after September 7, and Abbott was in a position where he could negotiate to become Prime Minister, it's very hard to imagine him walking away from that prize. And if he did decide to reach an agreement, he would just then have this broken promise kind of hanging around his neck as Prime Minister. So Yeah, I was kind of surprised that they made that move.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's a sort of, you know, it's not a massive Abbott gaffe of the kind, all of it's waiting to occur because he's been holding up for 3 years. It's a bit like waiting for the volcano to erupt. But I think this was an instinct that he came out with it, and that also feeds into the internal narrative that Abbott's got about being a strong and decisive leader, you know, Howard 2.0. And I think that's the, I'm never going to negotiate with the crossbenchers. Is he going to have to make good on this? That'll be interesting to watch. I tend to think, you know, if you look at how things play out, even if we get a really close electoral outcome, the odds are still in the favour of coalition stitching together a fairly comfortable majority, particularly given that the two New South Wales independents are leaving rather than get voted out. They're quietly packing their bags themselves, and they're almost a lay-down mazare to be LNP pickups. So I think the prospect of him having to stitch forth separate independents together to make a coalition is actually quite small. So it is risky because I think Nicholas is absolutely right. When faced with the opportunity of forming government, as he is reputed to have said during 2010, I'd sell my ass to form government, which is what he said, as said to have said Tony Windsor, he'd do it again if he gets the opportunity. But I think that's actually a relatively low probability outcome.
Yep, I agree. Yeah, chances of it actually happening are pretty low.
Abbott's ass being on sale for government, low probability event.
Well, I'm sure that Tom Waterhouse will have odds on that at any point now. Kevin Rudd has taken what is arguably the hardest stance ever against asylum seekers. Is he trying to undermine Abbott's pledge to stop the boats, or is there more at stake here?
It's clearly, firstly, neutralising the Libs, or the relentless stop the boat stuff that's been around for years and years now, and on which clearly electoral hay had been made out in the west of Sydney. This stuff evidently is electoral kind of catnip. And so if the ALP was going to be in any way viable, they're going to have to see this perceived weakness off. But I think there's also a policy point underneath it all, which was that when Rudd came in, he was like, we'll wind back the Howard policies because we think they're unreasonable. And what then there was the language of push and pull factors. We think, you know, the push factors are what's driving people, not the pull ones. And so they wound that back and found it ultimately didn't work. And they've tried it, they've rolled the dice a few times and have decided that this could actually be something that does prevent asylum seekers coming on boats and give them an electoral payoff. Whether it plays out, we'll have to wait and see. But I think they're getting a two-for-one on this. Lying behind Rudd's right positions on a few things is anti-green signalling. Because I think one of the problems that the ALP found in government was this, the accusation that the Libs pushed that worked really well to say, you're really the Greens, you know, you're the handmaidens of Bob Brown. And there's one MP and half a dozen senators and you're doing all these green policies, this is crazy. And I think there's been a lot of effort by the ALP to signal stuff that's not just about voters in Western Sydney or suburban Brisbane or wherever, but also about saying a vote for the ALP is not a vote for the Green. Clear product differentiation. I think that feeds into this, but they'll keep it quiet. But I think it's not far from centre stage in their minds.
The numbers that they said it's going to cost them, they're funnelling $632 million over 4 years into Papua New Guinea and an additional $420 million into aid. So that's safely over $1 billion there. Is that a good way to put money into dealing with such a problem?
No.
No?
It's crazy. It's unbelievably bad value for money. It's just not, I mean, it's breathtakingly expensive and crazy in any rational cost-benefit analysis of these things. The way the asylum seeker issue has played out in the Australian political landscape is peculiar. It's got this funny status where the normal rules don't apply. So the normal financial rules don't apply, the normal political rules. You know, the numbers of people we're talking about are, by any reasonable sense, fairly small, and yet it has a powerful pull on the popular imagination, particularly amongst electors in marginal seats. So the normal rule book goes out the window.
Rudd has said that the economy needs careful management, not massive spending cuts the coalition intends to make. The new budget predicts a $30.1 billion deficit. The coalition won't commit to a number. Who should we believe when it comes to crunching the numbers? We'll start with Nick.
Which one?
I'm just having fun with
you're
that.
You're just having fun. You are enjoying it. There's a tried and true method that governments normally use. If the opposition wins, where you can get into office and then say, turns out that the budget's in a worse state than we realised, we're now going to have to bring in a whole lot of deep cuts to get things back into balance. So my guess is it's quite likely that that would happen should the opposition win.
I take a slightly different view, which is this is macroeconomic modelling. And macroeconomic modelling is the closest thing in economics to voodoo. It's guesswork. It's absolute guesswork at the best of times. And essentially, it's guesswork predicated on a set of big number inputs that are themselves guesses. And they've got a series of models that are matched up against time series. And they work out, they think, how it's going to work. So it's always guesswork at the best of time. The problem is where the global economy is at today, and the Australian economy itself, effectively in a cycle that doesn't match any of the time series that they build these things on. Everywhere in the world, macroeconomic modelling on what you're sort of likely to get in terms of revenue, in terms of where GDP is going to go, is all over the place. So don't believe anyone when they tell you anything about what the economy is doing, particularly if they're a professor in macroeconomics.
It shows an amazing amount of confidence, though, on the part of the coalition, doesn't it? The fact that they think, no, we don't need to say what we think the numbers are going to be or where the money's going to come from. We're still going to go fine in this election as it is.
But they don't have to. I think that's the thing. I wouldn't if I were them. I mean, why make a guess which you can then be shown to be completely wrong when you can be a small target, do as Nicholas said, you can sit there and by mumbling your way through it, you then get the advantage when you get into government and say, they lied, the Beazley black hole. This is the Howard playbook on this stuff. And frankly, there's not a lot to be gained from the government sitting there going, where are your numbers? Where are your numbers? Where are your numbers? You can get a little bit of payoff by saying, right, you've said you're going to do this, how are you going to pay for it? But getting into arguments about economic forecasting in an election campaign is crazy. So I think it's perfectly understandable why the coalition would do it.
Can we have the quote from the Daily Telegraph again, please, Julia?
The Daily Telegraph said this: finally, you now have the chance to kick this mob out.
For my last question, is the Daily Telegraph just a Liberal pamphlet?
Has been for years.
Who's this election against? Is it Rudd v Abbott or is it Rudd v Murdoch?
I think the Murdoch press generally has been anti-ALP for a long, long period of time. And there's no mystery here. Why Murdoch wants to get rid of the ALP is a slightly separate issue, why the Murdoch press hates them so much. But what I think is crazy is the ALP fixating on this and going on and on about Tony Abbott's a stooge of Rupert Murdoch and this sort of stuff. This is just, who cares? A, firstly, we know this. B, the electoral research on this stuff is quite interesting. Newspaper headlines not shift voter preferences. Newspaper headlines follow voter preferences. And there's years and years of research, mostly in Britain on this, where they have a much more volatile press than we do, or a much more vivid press, shall we say. I think the ALP is making a really big tactical error by paint the coalition as the stooges of Murdoch and the puppets of the strings of, the octogenarian, thrice-married media baron. It has almost no benefit for them to do it and gets them off the message that they need to be saying, which is, we're good on the economy and the like. So why Murdoch hates the ALP so much, I'm not sure. The general thinking with Murdoch is he's got a fairly good kind of electoral radar who works out who's going to win and butters them up. And so, if anything, I think that's probably what's going on. The idea that Murdoch is spending millions and millions of dollars to save his investment in Foxtel, I find a little hard to believe. Because if you look at where Foxtel fits in the News Corp business model, it's a footnote in their revenue stream. So, mind you, he's a man of considered passion, so that could be it.
Yeah, I agree. It's probably, I don't think probably attacking Murdoch or News Limited is a particularly good strategy electorally for the ALP to adopt. Having said that, that sort of headline, the day the election's announced, is a pretty extraordinary one. I guess the only advantage is that it's not particularly subtle. There's no hidden messages there. It's right there on the front page. But yeah, it's pretty extraordinary.
In Britain, my favourite one was in the 1992 election where the British Labour government lost to John Major after the Tories had defenestrated Maggie Thatcher. The day before the election, can't recall, one of the two, had a light bulb, dark room, and says, the last person leaving Britain, please turn out the light. And it was just like, okay, yep. That was the Sun, owned by Murdoch. They got form on this stuff.
What's going to be interesting, actually, is seeing how, particularly because Murdoch's obviously under a huge amount of pressure on other fronts internationally at the moment. So what's actually going to be interesting is to see, what happens, I think, in the next few years with the Australian media landscape more generally, particularly the Murdoch empire. Yeah. Mm.
Associate editor of The Australian, Chris Kenny, tweeted this morning, Labor already recruiting a post-Rudd leader, which is likely correct because they'd want to, cover every base. Yeah, what's your thinking of that, Nick?
The recruiting of it or the tweet?
Either, really.
Either. I mean, there is some interesting speculation about what's going to happen after the election, come what may, even if Rudd wins. Because I think if Rudd wins, the ALP has barely papered over the divisions they've got. Rudd is... I mean, he won a reasonable majority in caucus, but there's still a fairly large chunk of the caucus that hate his guts. And if they're in with a viable majority, that's not going to keep happy for too long. The best case scenario you can think on the numbers is that they'll have maybe a six-seat majority, maybe. They're going to be lucky to form government even if all the cards go their way. There are these big divisions within the party that aren't going to be papered over. So we could get more destabilisation, even though Rudd's tried to preempt that with this lockdown. If they lose, does Rudd quietly take his bat and ball and go to Geneva or wherever he's, you know, dreaming of going? No. He's the electoral terminator. You know, this is a guy who will keep going until he gets what he wants, or kills you, or both. The idea that if they push him out the door, if they lose and they push him out the door, that Rudd will just leave. You know, Rudd thinks he's the greatest prime minister the country's ever seen. He doesn't let facts get in the way of that self-image. So any ALP leader is going to have to firstly murder Rudd or convince him to leave. He is a fratricidal guy who's going to continue to do this for so long as he's in the party.
Yeah, again, I think I'd largely agree with that. And I think particularly if Labor loses the election, my guess is that Rudd will want to stick around, possibly as opposition leader. But I'm guessing some of the internal conflict relating to the Gillard-Rudd stoush will resurface there, I imagine, quite vividly if they end up in opposition.
Unless the Tories absolutely smash them in the campaign, which is possible, you know, and they pick up a nice, large, healthy 96-style majority, which is pretty unlikely. But that aside, the most likely event is a smallish win by either side, which means we're back in the same place in 3 years and 3 years. So if you're an aspirant leader thinking, I'm always not too far away from being Prime Minister, I'm ever not too far away from my chance. In some respects, it's a function of the three-year electoral cycle. You know, if you're Rudd, if you're like the UK and you've got a five-year term and you miss out, you really got to bide your time for a long while before you're back in with a chance. Whereas with us, you're never more than 18 months away from hope. And given the way the electorate is breaking at the moment, that's a really, it's a recipe for this kind of volatility within the party. And the one thing we haven't talked about, though, which perhaps we'll come back to in later podcasts, is the way in which the Libs themselves are going to face these divisions. Because there are big divisions on policy terms within the Liberal Party. They've papered over them very well and have been very disciplined in their approach so far. But, you know, you think about the big three issues, whether it's, broadly speaking, social policy, whether it's gay marriage or what have you, climate change and education policy, they're really divided, really seriously divided. And if they get into government, they're going to have these big fights as well. So I think what we've got is a historical circumstance which is going to be quite electorally volatile within the parties and between the parties over a reasonable period of time. So it's not just post-Rudd. I think post-Abbott will be an interesting thing to watch and within the coalition.
We'll now throw it open to the audience. Is there any questions from the floor at all?
Yeah, this morning Rudd announced that Peter Beattie has joined the campaign trail for Queensland. I'm just wondering what you people think that has to do with ALP's chances in Queensland, whether it will help or hinder.
I'd imagine it would help them quite a lot in Queensland, as I think Beattie's still, as I understand, a reasonably popular figure in Queensland, reasonably popular premier. And he's also one of the few political leaders in Australia in recent times who actually basically left office on his own terms, willingly departed, wasn't defeated in an election nor removed by the party. The other thing that's really interesting about it is if Labor were to win government, and assuming that Beattie ends up on the front bench, potentially you have two former premiers in Bob Carr and Peter Beattie on the front bench. And also, depending on what happens in WA, a senior minister there, Alana McTiernan, who's running for Stephen Smith's seat of Perth. I'm not sure what the polling's showing at the moment, but he's got a chance of winning. So you could end up with two premiers and a very senior state minister in cabinet at the same time, which is be a pretty interesting development.
Yeah. The only thing I'd add is the polling must be looking good for the ALP in Queensland for Beattie to sign up. He's not going to sign up to something where it's a long shot. And same with Alana McTiernan in Perth. You know, the polling was looking really bad for the ALP until she put her hand up, and then all of a sudden, ooh, hang on, momentum is looking good for the ALP. Because remember, they were facing every seat in Queensland gone by St. Kevin of Rudd.
Yeah, I was just wondering what you thought of what the centrepiece of the campaign would be for both camps.
Nicholas and I were saying when we were walking down to the studio that it's been an odd first week in that it's hard to put your finger on what the key themes of the campaigns are, because normally they come out from the start and you're really clear. And Rudd opened up with a rehash of Howard's line, you know, who do you trust, which I think is asking a question like that of the electorate of a government that's clearly not popular is...
I believe he's actually unusual. Quoting Babylon 5.
May indeed. Kevin, John Howard is quoting Babylon 5. That's the real kicker. Having said that, I think the ALP is going to run on prudent economic management, and particularly they think that, and I assume they have polling to show it, that Abbott is A, unpopular, and where he's weakest is on economic policy. Their own narrative is they handled the GFC really, really well. They think that, plus schooling and education more generally, are the things on which they're going to hang their hat. Essentially, they're betting on as to whether the electorate will basically say, we look back in the past 5 or 6 years as a period of good economic times, relatively speaking or not. The problem they've got is that the electorate doesn't feel like it's been good economic times, even though it has been. And there's a really, really silly thing to do is to say, no, don't trust your own instincts. Trust me when I tell you, you should be feeling good about the past 5 years. It doesn't work. They've got a tricky message to sell. I think the coalition campaign so far is basically the Telegraph front line, kick these buggers out. And Abbott has occasionally touched on a really, he said it a couple of times, and I'm sure we'll hear more of it, is, do you really want another six more years of this? And it's a great throwaway, not throwaway line, but it's a nice encapsulation of the old electoral adage, which is governments lose office, oppositions don't get voted in. That's my guess as to where they're going. But it's interesting how unclear it's been so far, that it's quite a choppy campaign to date. But, you know, we're only 5 or 6 days in. It's a 33-day campaign, relatively long. So wait and see. Perhaps in a week or two's time, it'll be a little clearer.
Yeah, I agree. It's been very difficult to read the first week of the campaign. Just to pick up on one thing there, the issue of education. It was interesting that Abbott sort of shifted his stance on the Gonski reforms, which is obviously, I guess, their polling must be telling them that this is an issue that's doing them some damage in the electorate. So they're moving to kind of neutralise that as much as they can.
Yeah, we can't call it Gonski anymore.
Yeah, that's right. You're right.
Gonski. Not Gonski. It's
better schools.
Better school reform. Better schools, they've got better funding for schools. Better funding for schools, I think. More money for schools.
Yeah. But where is that funding coming from?
You mentioned volatility in the environment and the divisiveness in the Liberal Party. How safe is Abbott's leadership no matter which way the election goes?
I think if they lose, he's toast.
The man behind the curtain looks rather convincing.
Which one?
Malcolm Turnbull.
Turnbull. Wow. Turnbull's convincing. There's a great tweet that when Rudd got back in from some Liberal figure, I can't recall who it was, he said, if they can have their most popular leader, why can't we have ours? The problem is Liberal Party room hate him with a passion. They can't stand Turnbull. So you've got a funny mirror in many respects of the Rudd situation. I think if he loses, he'll walk. If he wins, that's the really interesting. If he wins by a bit, will they topple him? Nicholas Mose knows the Liberal Party history much better than I do, but my guess is the Liberal Party are much more instrumental and are much more disciplined historically. They tend to understand the basic rule of Westminster politics, which is divided parties lose, and the electorate doesn't like them. So I think if he wins, he's probably got a term, at least term and a half. He isn't electorally popular and has significant weaknesses, so he's in no means cast in stone in that position.
The Liberal Party generally works best when it's kind of united behind a strong leader. And generally, when a leader's not in a position of strength, that's where there's a lot of leadership instability. That's when the party's had a lot of trouble electorally. Like the 1980s, Howard and Peacock, for example, was a case in point. What's really interesting, though, is just the degree of changes in leadership we've had around Australia in the last even 5 years. So during the first term of the during the Rudd government, we had three opposition leaders. We had a change of prime minister. And also here in Victoria, we've had a change of Premier. Northern Territory has also had a change in Chief Minister as well. So whether or not this is indicating that there's something going on that means that leadership's becoming much less stable across the board, I don't know. It'll be interesting to watch that over the next few years.
And the small matter of the New South Wales premierships of the Labor government.
And of course, in the New South Wales, yeah, exactly. That's the best illustration of all. So there's been a huge amount of kind of instability when it comes to leadership across the board. Some of that's affected the Liberal Party as well. So it will be really interesting to watch what happens if it's the case that Abbott becomes Prime Minister. The other issue, I guess, for Abbott is if some of it will probably depend on the margin. If they only sort of scrape into office, having been ahead for a long period of time in the polls, that would probably weaken his position a little bit as well. I guess we'll know shortly.
That's all the time today for the podcast. I'd like to thank my guests today, Nick, and also to Julia for doing our announcing. Can we get a big round of applause for everyone today? And next week's guest will be Professor Judith Brett from Politics, and I hope you join us soon.
Taking part in Australia Decides 2013 was Professor Nick Bisley, Dr. Nick Barry, and the host was Matt Smith. And the announcements were read by me, Julia Scott. You can download this podcast and many more from La Trobe University on iTunes U or at the blog, podcast.blogs.latrobe.edu.au.